You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with myself, Rowan Walker. In this episode, I'm speaking with Neil Banderi on high-fidelity simulation training within practice. So what I want to do really is look at how high-fidelity simulation and indeed training has got multifactorial benefits through a number of reasons, really, through integration of handover simulation, debrief simulation, stress inoculation, skill acquisition under stress, and then communication under applied stress as well. So to do this, I have Dr. Neil Banderi with me. Neil is the head of education and training at MedStar Retrieval HEMS service based in Adelaide. He's also a consultant in emergency medicine at the Royal Adelaide Hospital and has trained as an emergency physician and worked previously as a consultant at St. George's Hospital Major Trauma Centre in London. If that wasn't enough, he's also been a retrievalist and ED doctor within Kent Surrey Sussex Air Ambulance prior to moving out to Australia. So Neil emigrated to Australia in 2016, where he worked as an emergency specialist at Townsville Hospital in North Queensland, and then currently as head of education for MedStar Retrieval Service. Welcome to the podcast, Neil.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
Neil, it's fantastic to have you on. Just get your steer on high fidelity simulation. Maybe if we could just start by asking, why does high fidelity training, why is it necessary in this environment? And indeed, why does it have to be as close to reality as possible?
I think the challenges that the pre-hospital clinicians face, are more often than not, when you're looking at the HEMS services and the pointy end of the clinical aspects, is that it's quite high stress. They're challenging environments alongside doing critical care skills. So how my interest is, how can we best prepare our colleagues in a simulation environment, in the training environment, for when they go out on that on the job for real? And I think being able to simulate real life scenarios and stresses is really powerful. It's been a learning curve. So initially, I did it when I started to just train individuals on how I was taught in through simulation. And looking back, I was put under a lot of pressure and was maxing out, and I just imploded, right? I wasn't very good at it, and it just wasn't particularly beneficial in hindsight. And so when I design the scenarios, it's more looking at the non-technical aspects primarily. And another arm is to look at if we're looking at a skill set, it's to drill the skill in a safe environment in a skill station. And then once the clinicians are comfortable with that, we bring it into the simulation environment and add in incremental pressures. So they don't get too maxed out, but there's enough learning there for them. And it's a delicate balance. I think it's unproductive, really, from a personal point of view, to just completely overwhelm the clinician in a simulation where they just don't get anything out of it. So that's the fine line I'm kind of trying to tread.
Listen, I fundamentally agree with that, Neil. I think, like you said, building up initially confidence, but then and microtask, and then putting it more all together within the environment. But like you said, kind of sort of making sure that they feel, clinicians feel comfortable with indeed skill acquisition from this just micro tasks, and then bringing in incremental stressors so that it starts to align with what they'll see in reality. But to your point, actually, it's a really interesting point, because I think we've walked a similar journey in this regard, whereby if you come in too heavy-handed initially and just max clinicians out, indeed yourself, and I've been in this position where you just feel overwhelmed and learning stops and actually fear kicks in, and actually it doesn't be the sum total of the experience doesn't then actually lend itself to being a productive one, or indeed one which promotes safe practice. You just learn to be fearful and indeed become overwhelmed quite quickly with the environment.
Yeah, and you know, what you don't want is your colleagues to suddenly go into that kind of fight or flight mode during a simulation, and it just doesn't work, right? You've just negated the whole point of the simulation. So it's designing the sim and running the sim in such a way that they don't hit that point. And there's a whole lot of how we, you know, brief the sim and debrief the sim, and which I can, you know, expand on later on. And it's using a hive mindset. So I'm very fortunate to have quite a strong training team with a wealth of experience from across paramedicine, medical, nursing, and in the pre-hospital environment I can draw experiences from in order to mold that sim for our new trainees, whether it's paramedics, nursing, or medical staff.
Neil, that's fantastic. And that kind of answers the question I was just about to ask, which is around what are your endpoints? And I think, as you said before, the endpoints are largely non-technical, embedded with a few technical skills across the stream, but you're looking for the sort of non-technical aspects to come out in that simulation. So let's go to what you were just inferring there around debriefing and whether you indeed train in debriefing and if there's a prescriptive debriefing template that you use. I know you're looking at sort of the aligned non-technical skills throughout the simulation, but do you film the debrief? Do you then feedback on the debrief, and indeed do you use a template?
So where it started, when I took on the role a couple of years ago as head of training, the foundations was pretty solid from my predecessors. They'd set up this wonderful training system. And I thought, well, how can I move this forward? And so what I got is I got some external people to come in and watch how we run our kind of orientation program for the new doctors and nurses and paramedics. And it was looking at how primarily I said, look, can you just look at how we run the sims and what you think? And these were people from various backgrounds within pre-hospital care, military primarily. And what was really interesting to say is, like, you've got all these facilitators running multiple sims, but you're not briefing the candidates properly in a set format. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is when you're debriefing, you're all debriefing in a different way. And so the learner is either getting overwhelmed with the amount of knowledge and feedback points that come across. And so they're going to the next sim and just feeling more confused. So what we did is I sat down with the team and I said, right, we're going to come up with a briefing template and a debriefing template that we're all going to use for each sim. So then the learners are having a consistent feedback, consistently being fed back in the same way. So what we used for the briefing was the kind of the SMEAC, the situation, mission, execution, admin kind of communication style. So this is the briefing template we're going to use. And the debriefing is, it was kind of a mixture of various sources. So we look at a brief synopsis. We've only got, like, say, 5 to 8 minutes after a sim to debrief. So we look at a brief synopsis and we get the learner to say what was positive aspects and things they'll do differently. And the facilitator is really there if the learner's getting stuck, and they can look at time points during that debrief. So, for example, one of the things we look at would be, all right, look, at that critical intervention, if they're getting stuck, you did this. All right. Oh, okay. Yeah. So do you want to expand on that? And then we'll kind of summarize. And the last thing is we ask them three things. So, you know, what would you stop doing? What would you keep on doing? And what would you start doing? So keep it very simple. And then the final thing that I learned on the feedback was we started recording not every sim, because we can record every sim, we've got the ability to record every sim, but it takes a long time to then be able to go through it and go through it with a trainee. And that's just not practical in my line of work. So what we decided to do was, at the end of the orientation two-week block, our trainees go through their final scenario, which is more usually kind of high complex, like clinically quite complex in a complex environment. And we slowly build up the sims from an easy clinical aspect and an easy environment, and we go through up to a clinically challenging and environmentally challenging. And I've just on a pretty simple on a GoPro, we'll film them. They're aware we're filming them. And then about 2 weeks after, two, 3 weeks after, when they start their kind of rotation with us, I'll get them into the office and we'll just go through it. We'll go through the video. I've gone through it and I'll highlight at certain aspects. But what's really powerful is getting them to say their learning points. So I'll just often be quiet and they'll run through. It's like, look, oh, I noticed. Did that. That's what I do. I didn't really pick up on that. That's how my mannerisms are. Or in fact, if I'd moved the patient a meter back towards the ambulance, it would have saved a lot of back and forth, you know, when we're doing the RSI checklist and stuff. So that's been really powerful. And then I asked them, would you mind if we got all the registrars in your cohort to come and watch this? They will, and they said, and invariably they'll say, yeah, sure. And then you've got that hive mindset of they're all learning together and they're all happy to do that. So that's something we've changed in the recent years. We've got really kind of good feedback on that process.
Listen, that's fantastic. And I think what that speaks to is because I think we are so unifocal as people, not even as clinicians. Filming things probably picks up on aspects of care or indeed the environment or the task which you would miss otherwise, because we're so focused on delivering safe care. But and there's all these other aspects which actually are feeding into and affecting care, like you said, the logistical distance between the ambulance and or patient and resources, the impinging noise from the environment might be the body language and or eye contact, all these, you know, name attribution, closed loop communication, but all these things which are negated by the clinician, because what you're doing quite rightly is you're triaging information just to make sure you're delivering on checklist, you're delivering safe practice, but the camera is capturing all these aspects. But could you maybe speak to the environmental factors you put into play within simulation, because they are fundamentally important. It's such a succinct shift from in hospital care, you know, the noise of the engine, the noise from a motorway lane which isn't closed down, the speak of the clinicians, the bystanders, and actually sometimes this can directly impinge practice, and even to the point where there's maybe a pre-prescriptive ceiling of care that you may want to adhere to within an ambulance, within an aircraft, and actually that ceiling of care changes when you're on scene, so that you're not trying to orchestrate or deliver complex medicine within the back of an aircraft. Could you speak to these environmental factors which you inject within the training?
Yeah, and look, and again, it goes down to having that kind of incremental stresses being applied. I've got to be honest, more often than not, when particularly if someone hasn't done pre-hospital care before and they're coming to us, a lot of it is self-generated from the doctor. And they'll feel themselves getting more stress. And you can see that when you're watching them, that you don't need to inject a huge amount to really test them. They're already putting pressure on themselves. And a task that they would easily complete in a hospital setting, for example, inserting an eye gel into someone who's arrested, merely just put them in a helicopter with a helmet and a Switlic on strapped in, automatically they're stressed out, especially if they haven't been put in that situation before, right? We use staff as kind of extra actors. So for example, we go to a lot of rural GP clinics and, you know, by instead of just having a GP come in at that inopportune moment during a critical intervention and asking questions, that kind of, we know that happens in real life. So it's not completely out there. And so that simple intervention, you can see that the clinician is getting more and more overloaded cognitively. Even just the mere phone of having an iPhone or a phone recording them. That's a common thing that we use and a simple thing that happens in day-to-day life. It's probably the first time they've experienced that. And afterwards, we kind of unpack that and use strategy and give them strategies to kind of manage that. And then it goes through to simple things like one of our scenarios is we'll say, right, you're being tasked to a four-year-old hit by a car. And so we ask them, you know, what are you thinking en route to the job? Any extra bits of equipment? You know, what are your thought processes within the team? And they get to the job and it's a four-month-old. And over the radio, you know, it's just comms issue. And so then they suddenly have to switch tack to like, now I'm dealing with a four-month-old. And just that mere switching of the communication will really overload them to some degree. Now, at some point, you might have to say, right, we're just going to stop. I'm going to take a breath if they're completely getting overloaded. But that's all part in the brief. So we say in the brief, at some point in the scenario, we may stop, have a pause and talk moment, but that's okay. Right? So they don't feel like they've completely failed the scenario as such. And we use that, for example, when we're doing teaching them about, we put in a few pacing wires in the rural setting for complete heart block, and they may have never put a pacing wire in. So when we're running the scenario, that's one of the ones that we say, right, we're going to pause here. We're going to go through the pacing kit, how you insert it. Okay, so they don't feel like, oh, God, I've completely messed this up, and now they're having to pause it. So that's all part that kind of leads back to the kind of briefing side of things. So, but the overarching message is that we don't want to push them so much that they stop learning. You want to push them just to know the kind of continue to learn, and the stress of the training environment isn't detrimental to their learning, if that kind of makes sense.
It's a real art, actually, Neil, to your point, because I think that place and that line is different in every individual, and it's learning to look at the subtle nonverbal cues that people are expressing, often in their eyes and in the, interestingly, you know, we talk about bandwidth, don't we? But the way in which they process information and almost certainly communicate, when that starts to slow down, you can, I suppose, especially from an observer, you can start to see that their mental bucket, their bandwidth is filling quite quickly. And again, it's a real art in just saying, right, now time out, because there's some learning here, and it's learning versus overwhelm. And but to your point as well, actually, you know, it doesn't take much to, and I would be the first one to admit myself, you know, moving from a four-year-old to a four-month-old, that involves some complex maths, actually, you know, especially, you know, tube sizes, drugs, different interventions, and that shift alone can start to switch a lot of cognitive buttons. And if you haven't got a checklist to maybe mitigate and or delegate those maths, and or if it's the first time you're, you know, providing a pediatric anesthesia, that alone can be enough to overwhelm the clinician. From a an environmental perspective, are you also looking to see what the clinician does from sort of trying to silence the environment as much as possible? So the classic cases, you know, four suction units are on, the rotary blades might be on in the distance, the engines are on, all of which is feeding into a lack of communication and a lack of understanding and reciprocation. Are you looking for that from the clinician as well?
Yeah, and look, I more than not, if they haven't experienced that before, they won't know or feel empowered that they can say, can we just stop the fire engine or stop all the equipment that you're using? This is a critical intervention we're doing now. And that's something that where video is quite powerful. You show them that, look, if you just ask fire officer or the police to shut down the equipment, that would have helped you. Oh, yeah, that's really important. Another aspect is for the helo scenario where we have a patient that arrests in the helo, being able to show the registrar, look, you know, simple things like just knowing how to unlock yourself from the harness safely. Things about knowing where your equipment are is. And so I took the registrar then back into the helo and said, right, we're just going to mentally rehearse this, you know, put the helmet on, put the sweet look on, and sit in the back of the helo. Just imagine, close your eyes, imagine the same patient. And you can use your hands and go through just where's a bit of equipment I'm going to use, what I'm going to say to the pilot. Okay, now we're going to run the scenario again. And that's been very useful, I think, for our trainees to have that, the ability and the time to go through that, because in a hospital, we wouldn't have that opportunity as much. But I think it also, it's really important to tell the clinicians that it's okay to make a mistake. And we're not looking for perfection. It's you're human. It's important to realize when you feel stressed. So your physiology around it, you feel flushed, you feel tachycardic, but just have to ride it out. It will pass. That feeling will pass, right? And it's difficult because you're entering a job when you're trying to take all this bits of information, compute it, and make a decision. And that's tough. It's okay. But you'll learn how to do that. And I say this thing, that my mantra is like, you know, when you come across a mistake that you've made, then you just got to acknowledge it, accept it, and move on. You know, and change something and move on. So it's setting that environment from the beginning to say, look, we're not looking for perfection, right? We understand you're new to this game, but this is the strategies we can use. And so, you know, part of that might be, and it's using that vulnerability. So I often say tell my story, and I'll say, look, I found it very difficult when I started in pre-hospital medicine. But it clicked, and then you start to improve and use the strategies. And if you show that even, you know, the senior members of the service have vulnerabilities, then that throughout, not only particularly even for the simulations, but also when we're going through cases for review, it allows for greater learning, I think.
Really interesting, actually, because like you said, it's your relationship with failure, actually. And what's fascinating about that is, what is your relationship with failure? Because does it affect your forward moving, forward thinking interventions? Does it affect your performance moving forward? Or fundamentally, can you sit with it, accept it, and then for it to not accept it, change your performance going forward? You know, the old adage of the best Formula One drivers can leave the last corner behind them versus the ones which affect the rest of the race. And I think it's prudent in any simulation to test people's relationship with failure, so you can understand and they can understand for it to not affect both their performance, the team's performance, and indeed the patient outcomes moving forward. But just looking at what I wanted to do is visit crisis communication, or indeed escalating communication with you, and just what you would be looking for from clinicians to mitigate some of these issues. Before we just go to the communications piece, you know, what are you advocating around sort of high acuity, low occurrence versus high acuity, high occurrence skills? So are you advocating and looking for clinicians in simulation that they really sort of do any sort of high acuity, low occurrence skills, so those that they're not frequently having to deploy outside of the fixed finite sort of room of a helicopter in with the good 360 access versus the high acuity, high occurrence, or indeed what's the baseline for intervention? Is it outside of a fixed environment versus inside of a fixed environment? The only reason I'm asking this is because, you know, London Hems, we say, look, no peri-arrest patients are going in the helicopter, because if they arrest in the helicopter, there's really not much you can do about it. But we have the luxury of taking all these patients really by ambulance. But whereas in a rural and remote location, the helicopter may be the only place in which you can put a peri-arrest patient in, which might, you know, you might be able to salvage. So it's, there's probably a very different threshold and indeed a working environment compared to an urban setting.
Yeah, look, absolutely. You know, some of our, we know that if we get a call for a retrieval to a rural setting, that's 5 hours from leaving base to getting back on base, right? And potentially we're covering distances of 500, 600, 700 kilometers. So the risk assessment is different to when I was working in an urban setting. And you know, when, if we've got a patient who's got, who's got a blunt trauma and is unstable hemodynamically, but they're, you know, an hour and a half fixed wing flight away with the team there, the only way that they're going to survive is to get them to a major trauma center. So you're going to have to get them on that plane. Okay. Well then, so how do we arm the clinicians to make that decision? And there's several layers. So we have a retrieval consultant on the phone 24/7. They can ask for advice, which I know a lot of services have, and back them, back their decision-making. And making sure that they've got their kind of what-if plans to hand, knowing that there is some risks to putting a peri-arrest patient in the back of an aircraft for an hour and a half. Right, they may well arrest. Okay, you've put that in your mind. That's already been verbalized. Okay, now what are we going to do if they arrest? Okay, right, great. And more so that... not only that, it's like, right, even saying to, they say, going by Hilo, you know, when we debriefed a case recently, I made a plan about what if they arrest en route to the, and they're, you know, so, well, what about, did you make a plan of what to do if they're arrested in that sterile cockpit as on landing? What are you going to say? What are you going to do? Oh, you know, actually, you know, we didn't. That's a good point, actually. We could have been more explicit about that communication with the pilots and stuff. So our, although we would advocate, you know, getting outside 360 access as much as possible for all our intervention and getting them, at some point we're going to have to move. And it's a case of doing what's needed at that time, but also keeping the momentum going that they need to get to a ICU or a trauma center. But we've got the challenge of low resources and distance. The mindset has to change from having, you know, being 10 minutes away from a major trauma center with your patient.
So let's look at the communication piece now, Neil, and just look at what you're looking for from the clinicians, because, you know, the adage of closed loop communication, sharing the mental model, and indeed mitigating some of the issues around the environment, but also speaking with your eyes, so good eye contact, use of names as possible, is something I would always steward. 90% of the time it would get you out of jail, but there is some situations where it's just still extremely difficult to communicate. COVID times the last year and a half. But what are you looking for from clinicians when you're studying these high fidelity simulations with extremely difficult comms?
So, it comes down to communication under pressure, right? And as you said, with COVID, we're still wearing masks, and that, so you lose that kind of that verbal communication. How can we work around that? So the thing that we, as you quite rightly said, closed loop communication and sharing that mental model, and also then going into that grade of assertiveness if needed on that kind of conflict resolution. And things that we kind of look for is we're very hot on huddles at set points during a mission. And one of the things we teach is, you know, after your kind of primary survey and you're doing your clinical synthesis, well, have a huddle. But, and often they'll just have a huddle between the two of them. So, well, no, you had a huddle with everyone that's involved in that patient's care, whether it's in a hospital or on the roadside. and have that plan and share that plan with them. I say, you know, if you're dealing with a pediatric patient and the parents are around on scene, perhaps get mum in and talk to mum, but also have everyone listening in. So then you're keeping mum involved and aware, but also everyone else is aware of what's going on. And that's kind of a nice way of doing that. So we have, so the huddles, we look at the a pause and plan. So if things are going awry, and you know, one of our nursing colleagues is very good at saying, right, you know, time out, Neil, we need to time out. This is going the wrong direction. Okay, so kind of almost that reset. Using key phrases or keywords. So things like, right, this patient needs a general anesthetic, or it's time to huddle, and things like that. Can accept signposting. And it goes through to the end of the job, where you're giving that structured communication, that kind of in a handover template. What's also quite powerful is that we say, look, at the beginning of your shift, when you're working with your offsider, and you're doing whatever the checks or, you know, checking the bags and whatever, you know, we say, you know, go through your airway plan and talk about all the way through to where you'd stand on a Kaiko situation. But also say, look, I say to the paramedics for nursing staff, I'm with me, look, when I'm maxing out, I go quiet. Right. So just put your hand on my shoulder and say, Neil, like, stop messing around. We need to get back in the game. And that kind of just a reset from being task focused. And finally, one of the last aspects is it's the knowing when you're always going to get people that aren't going to work with you on a job, right? It happens. We all know that there's certain people that just don't gel with. Okay, well, how are you going to get them to work with you? And if in being nice and being inclusive works to some extent, but it's, at some point, if the patient's deteriorating, you're going to have to use that kind of graded assertiveness and say, you know what, at the end of the day, it's the patient that we care about. We can sort this out later, whether it's a hot debrief or inviting them to our, you know, to the open kind of case review stuff, and we can sort it out at that point. But as long as they are aware that that might be a possibility, that, as in our clinicians, that it's in the back of their head, that it's not suddenly they have to feel uncomfortable saying, stop, this is wrong. Oh, actually, the service has empowered me to say that.
Yeah, listen, it's really interesting to hear that, actually. And like you said, this graded assertiveness is absolutely key. We did a little bit of training recently with a provider, and one of the aspects we did was around forced failure. So it doesn't matter what you do with the patient, the patient dies. Testing what your relationship with failure is. Another one was an unhelpful leader, whereby there's leadership on scene already, and they're trying to be helpful, actually, but it's really unhelpful. So their positive attitude, whatever they're doing, is actually detrimental. But again, this forces this graded assertiveness. So we're looking to see whether clinicians can escalate their level of assertion and indeed concern. But it's difficult because the person and or leader is already being helped, is trying to be helpful. And so again, what we're trying to tease out there is, to your point, putting pleasantries aside for fundamental patient care, and getting a semblance of that's the baseline of why we're all here. And it's really interesting to see the fruition of those people that are very, very blue. So very people orientated, personality profiling, versus those that are very performance and or process orientated. And can we get back to this fundamental baseline of performance and process, whereby this is why we're all here in the first place? Neil, looking at your approach to, you mentioned handover recent, just in your last answer around recording the handover. What are you looking at from a good handover? What are the fundamental components?
Services have their own kind of template for how they want to deliver a handover and get all the vital information across. And we've got two different styles. And that's because we do both primaries and retrieval. So for our primaries, was taken from the UK kind of HEMS model template, and we want it in kind of under a minute. And when we're doing the sims, so we give them the template. So, right, we're just going to index there, go away. You've got a minute to write down, prep your handover. And this is the trauma team coming to do that handover and record it. And invariably, they'll be too long, depending on what specialty they've come from. They'll be either, you know, too long, not miss some bits of information. So, right, okay, do it again. But this time, do this, this, and this based on what they initially said. And that's been useful. What I do say is that, you know, if I'm on in a resus at the trauma center, or one of my colleagues who is a retrieval consultant is on, they're bringing a case in, whether it's a consultant or a registrar, you know, I know that they're coming in because we've had a call, early heads up. So, right, you know, I'm shooting the text saying, you happy if I just audio record your handover? And invariably, yeah, I know it's me asking, but they'll say, yeah, that's cool. And we'll record the handover. And then immediately after, I'll just airdrop it to them. So look, go away and listen to that. And then when we run the case review, so look, they don't have to play it if they don't want to. And they'll say, look, yeah, I listened to the handover. I was too long. I forgot this. Okay, that's really useful to know because I haven't listened to myself talk before. But we make sure we do it also with the consultants and say, right, well, look, this is what a consultant with experience says. And then the registrar has the opportunity to listen to that so they know what we're looking for in some respects. But the retrieval handover for a complex medical patient to an ICU needs a bit more detail potentially. But so it's a little bit longer with a few kind of more headings, more based on the past medical history and what actually happened in the hospital prior to us getting there. So it's a slightly different, and they're not all standing still waiting, you know, silence, like waiting for the patient. It's normally you go in, there's an ICU nurse is diligently waiting for the handover, and the doctor will kind of rock up at some point. And so it's a different environment and different mindset.
Yeah, it's interesting actually you say that, Neil, because like you said, it's less is more within the trauma handover from a primary intervention or ND patient versus a retrieval, where like you said, there's nuances, there's a very much more of a patient course, a documented patient course, and maybe already a pharmacological course which needs compliance to. So two different modalities. And actually it's prudent to, like you said, get it right according to modality, because too much information in a trauma handover and people will disengage, they won't necessarily listen, and they won't assimilate that information. So you have, it's almost headlines, and then they can come back for details later, versus a slow time retrieval handover, which is more nuanced, more intricate, and hopefully less time critical, because you've got some semblance of stability.
And the way we teach our clinicians is to say, right, you can do your handover and you walk out, do your paperwork, you come back in, hand the paperwork back to the team leader or the scribe, and say, if there's any other bits like, oh yeah, you know, it was a grade two intubation or whatever other bits that's relevant to at that point, you say to the team leader, right, at that point. That doesn't have to be said in your initial handover. You've got to give the opportunity to them to crack on and deal with the patient. You do your notes and then come back in and say, right, anything else? Well, by the way, it's these are the other bits, you know, relatives are en route or whatever. And then go out.
So looking at case review, Neil, so the D&D process and looking at sort of case review, Do you, within the short term or medium term, is there a lot of training needs and or simulation that comes from case review? So from hearing these anecdotal and or kind of prescriptive narratives, really, which is what case review is all about, and, you know, chronological, sequential, this is what went well, maybe this is what we would do differently. Can you sort of get a semblance of, right, actually, we do need to change tack, to change course, or address this training need through the case review process?
Look, I think in a well-governed pre-hospital system, you know, we're very good at identifying a learning need through case reviews. And we're very good at closing that loop. So we say, right, I've identified a learning need. It's a skill deficit, or it could be a human practice issue, or a knowledge gap. Right, we'll go away and say, right, okay, you know what? We haven't seen many of X pathology and dealing with that in a rural environment, but we can set a sim around that. And put people through that and close that loop. And that's as a result of having that robust and strong governance setup. If it's a skill issue, and I'll give you one example. So subclavian access, right? Some people are very adept at it. Some people haven't done much of it. What can we do to augment that? And we'll go away and we'll get a mannequin, we'll set up a skill station, and we'll have champions to run that skill station, because the training needs to be accessible 24/7, right? We have people on night shift, day shift, but they're adult learners, right? And we have a consultant or a senior paramedic around to be able to facilitate those sessions during the day. And so you've got certain champions within the service, and on the skill station, it will say, well, these are the champions for subclavian access, right? When they're on shift, get them to come and take you through that. Once you're happy, okay, that kind of tick on that knowledge gap has been sorted in some respects. So if it's a skill, we'll go with a skill station, and then we can potentially build that into a simulation. Now, it doesn't need to be a very complex scenario or simulation. It could be, right, we're just going to design a scenario where we've got difficult IV access. We're going through IO. I want you to put a subclavian line in this patient. What are you going to do? How are you going to set it up? And one of the feedbacks that we had was like, you know, potentially, why don't you start mentally rehearsing before the skill station? So we put air defenders on, an eye mask, and before we do the skill station, we'll get them to run through, right, okay, subclavian or Kaiko, right, what am I going to say, how am I going to position the patient, where is all my kit, just 5 minutes in silence, get them to do that, and then we teach them then we go through the actual skill. And that's been quite powerful as well.
It's interesting, like you said, I think partly what that's doing, it's embedding deep sort of subconscious neural pathways, really, and it, because I think what you probably want from the clinicians, what indeed I always want within practices, is actually to be able to utilize my finite attention on troubleshooting, but have really embedded and integrated a lot of subconscious motoric skill within the skill acquisition. So all that means is I have committed to subconscious memory the pattern and indeed sequence, so I can look at using my 5 to 10% of actual consciousness and indeed attention on troubleshooting the pain points, the pinch points, and communicating it aptly, and making sure that there is sort of some semblance of safety and cohesiveness going forward. But again, I guess before you ever commit to subconscious learning, it very much has to be conscious. So it's this slow time sequencing, yeah. Subconscious integration.
Yeah, and you can extrapolate that to, you know, a lot of our jobs in pre-hospital care is critical decision making, right? And when you have the opportunity in a case review or D&D to go through that, I changed tack in the way that I run some of those reviews. So I used to just have the case up on the screen, the team's there, and say, right, what do? You did this, this, this. And now on some of the cases, I anonymize it. So, right, and I pick a registrar in the group. And I pick a registrar primarily because we've learned that if I ask a consultant first what they're going to do on this case, so, you know, you're the team, this is what you get activated to or sent to, what are your thought processes, what are you thinking? Okay, I'm thinking this and this and this, and I'll do this and this and this. And then if I ask the reg afterwards, they will probably not feel that they could say, oh, I wasn't thinking that, I would have done this and this. So I started asking the registrar first and the paramedic or the nurse in their kind of in their fake team for the scenario, for the case, right? What are you thinking, right? And then I'd ask the consultant. Consultant, actually, you know, I know that in that rural facility, they don't have X, Y, and Z, or I know that there's a local doctor that can help you with that. Oh, okay. And that immediately have that kind of hive mindset of learning in that environment is really useful for someone who's not done the job before, is new to the service. So I think it's using your experience within the service and how you get the most out of that for the learning to be able to teach your new staff about what you're thinking, the heuristics, local knowledge, corporate knowledge, and being able to learn to do that on a weekly basis is really useful, because it's something that we didn't really have in the hospital setting.
Absolutely. I just before I progress to sort of maybe next and final question, just one of the things I try and do, or indeed advocate, and I've learned from other people actually, is the question, you know, am I missing anything? Because fundamentally you probably are missing something, and actually giving power to the team to speak into your practice and say, actually, Owen, have you considered a jaw thrust, or have you considered putting a second suction unit in just in case the first one fails, or that second IV line looks like it's blown. Yeah, all these subtleties, which actually are really important when the first line fails, and what it does, it also gives power to the team, hopefully flattens the hierarchy, but also just covers off the fact that you're going to miss things, and you're democratizing the received wisdom of the team. Like you said, local knowledge of what they can deliver at a local level is absolutely key, because then that's going to supplement and support your skill acquisition and what you can do. So I it was quite a releasing mindset and or question to ask, really, which is, you know, Neil, am I missing anything here? And you can say, actually, Owen, X, Y, and Z. And that really, that helps. Now, it's not fail safe and foolproof, but it's at least some kind of mitigation to your own fixed finite issues.
What I would say to that is when I'm doing a human factors lecture for our clinicians, and I'll say, look, you know, you want to be able to, and this is for in hospital, so you want to empower the team. Right. So as the team leader, if I'm the team leader as a senior consultant, saying, right, guys, is there anything I'm missing? Like, speak up. So I thought, okay, that's a pretty good way of doing it. And then I got feedback from particularly some of our female registrars and consultants who maybe, you know, more diminutive in stature. They'd say, yeah, but if I say that, it just comes across as though I don't know what I'm talking about. That's what I feel. That's what I think. And so I said, oh, I haven't really thought about that, actually. I said, why don't you flip it? Why don't you say, look, I think it's this because of this, this, and this. What does everyone else think? Oh, okay. And so it opened my eyes, I think, to perhaps only kind of unconscious biases I'd had when I'm teaching. And so I've had to change tack slightly in terms of, you know, being much more diverse and inclusive based on who I'm teaching.
No, that's excellent. I think that's fantastic. And actually, like you said, framing it into a place where just giving people permission to speak into your practice where they don't feel like they're bumping up against any presupposition or indeed issues. No, absolutely. Neil, as we just finally, before we look at take home messages, is there any incremental improvements that you're making across the service? I know you're starting to look and dig into sort of characterological and or sort of personality profiling, which I fundamentally agree with. I think it's a great way to sort of start to understand decision making and heuristics and bias and personality on scene. Is there anything like that you're starting to look at within training, which brings more insight into clinical practice?
Yeah, look. So as you mentioned, we're looking at the strength deployment inventory as a form of psychological assessment. In a couple of ways. One, about doing it on our clinicians within the service and seeing what attributes, are there any common attributes that are at play in our service that we want to look for in our selection. But also the ability then to tailor a sim around that for the learner. So if someone's more people orientated or process driven, can we use and tailor the sim to make sure the learner gets the maximum benefit based on what their personality is? And if we've only got six registrars, that's much easier to do than if I had 15 in an ED. The other way we're looking at it is a mentoring course. So we run halfway through the attachment with us, we do a buddy shift where a consultant will fly with the doctor, with the registrar and the team for the day. And what we found was, that's a pretty good idea. They kind of assess to see how they're going, how they're tracking, what they need to work on, how they're doing well in certain aspects and not so well in other aspects. We found there's no kind of framework we've given to the consultants and to the senior paramedics who are going to be observing. It's like, some people will step in too early or not at all. And so we're looking at using the personality. So if I can pair up a consultant with this personality on the SDI versus with a reg on this personality, how they're going to interact, when they would feel that would step in, and running like a 2-day kind of mentoring course for pre-hospital clinicians. And we're using case reviews to say, right, there's a need for example, our complex cardiac patients that we're retrieving, those needs that we probably can do better for those patients. We need to add certain drugs in using more advanced kind of echo skills, or whatever. How do we train that within our service to benefit those small subset of patients, but who are low occurrence, but kind of high consequence retrievals? So those are kind of the few things that we're looking at really for kind of the future.
So Neil, as we finish off on the conversation, could you maybe just speak to just some take-home messages, really, just for systems and or clinicians that are running simulation, critical care or otherwise, actually, part of ambulance services and or retrieval services. Could you speak to some take-homes which are sort of fundamental to look at and or address?
I think with simulation, everyone concentrates a lot on, and quite rightly, on debrief. I think being able to brief appropriately is really important. The ability to video and go through the video with the learner. And that it's building that incremental pressure and realizing that actually, as I said earlier, the clinician themselves will already almost be doing that on their own and spotting how they do that and when they do that. And you don't need to add too much pressure in and until you get to that kind of fine line where you don't want to cross into that fight or flight mode and negate the whole point of the simulation.
Yeah, listen, that's fantastic. Really wide-ranging answers and just really insightful as well. So that's absolutely fantastic. Listen, thank you for the last hour. Really do appreciate your insights and perspectives, Neil. So thank you.
Thanks, Owen. It's been great. Thanks for asking me to come and talk.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.